I'm Dr. Len Calabrese, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity entitled, A Team Approach to Improving Outcomes in Rheumatoid Arthritis, Clinicians, Patients, and Digital Health Coaches. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, a best-in-class accredited provider of continuing medical education for clinicians across the globe. Today's program is being streamed live and will be archived at cmeoutfitters.com. Be sure to share this link with your colleagues or team members who are not able to join us today, and I encourage you to visit the website for additional educational activities and patient resources, including access to the digital health tool called PacHealth that we'll be discussing during today's activity. I'd also like to encourage everyone to join in on our live Twitter conversation at RA Team. We'll be monitoring the Twitter feed and responding to your tweets as they come in. And don't forget to stay with us for our after the show segment. We're invited to call in and email us with your most challenging questions and cases. You know, the goal of today's activity is to ultimately help you improve the lives of your patients with inflammatory diseases. So please submit your cases, questions, and feedback. As I mentioned, I'm Dr. Len Calabrese. I'm professor of medicine and vice chairman of the Department of Rheumatic and Immunologic Diseases at the Cleveland Clinic. I'm looking forward to our discussion today, which will focus on a team approach to the care of patients with RA. I'm excited about our program, and we're going to share some best practices for creating and utilizing this team approach, and we'll provide some tips that any of you can integrate into your practice. So now, let me introduce our faculty joining me today. First, let me welcome my good friend, Dr. Stanley Cohen. Dr. Cohen is the co-director of the Division of Rheumatology at Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. He's also past president of the American College of Rheumatology and certainly known to the rheumatology community far and wide. Also, let me introduce Eileen Leiden. She is an adult nurse practitioner in the Department of Rheumatology at the NYU Langone Orthopedic Hospital. She's also a board member of the Rheumatology Nurses Society. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we're going to have some fun here.
Yeah.
So today's activity includes a number of unique educational enhancements. We put the voice of the patient, literally and figuratively, at the center of this program. In the initial step of our development process, I worked with the staff at CME Outfitters to design a survey. We sent a patient thought leaders. So all patients across the country are broadly sampled for their responses. These patient leaders are extremely active in social media and online inflammatory disease communities. We asked these thought leaders to share their thoughts with us on the very topics that we'll be discussing today. Throughout the program, you'll see and hear what they have to say, and we'll discuss that feedback and hopefully come up with ways to make sure our patients know that we're listening to them and getting this feedback. Also, we did a number of video shoots at the Cleveland Clinic, and we'll be integrating these videos throughout the program and discussing how all of you can integrate some of these best practices, I hope, into your practice. And we all look forward to your feedback on this process and any suggestions you might have going forward to improve it. Finally, we'll be discussing digital health coaching. And a specific program called PacHealth. We're excited that we'll be making this service available at no cost to the first 100 patients that all of you sign up. This will offer your patients 3 months of free personalized digital health coaching, and we're excited to be offering this great service to your patients. So we obviously have a lot to cover, so let's jump right in. We have three leading learning objectives that we want to get into today. So first, we're going to try to align treatment decisions with ACR recommendations, which support a treat-to-target approach in the care of your patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Secondly, we'll critically appraise the data on DMARD monotherapy as a treatment option, and this will include JAK inhibitors in patients with moderate to severe RA. And lastly, we'll integrate one best practice that can be utilized by the multidisciplinary care team to monitor signs and symptoms of methotrexate intolerance and medication non-adherence. So that's a kind of a tall task. We have a lot to talk about. Before we get started, I want to get our audience involved. So you'll see this question on your screen, and I ask you to give us your real response here. Do you currently use a formal tool to measure disease activity in all of your, or at least the vast majority of your patients with rheumatoid arthritis? Yes or no? I realize that you're busy, time is limited in practice, so there's definitely barriers to using these measures. So, you know, be as candid as you can be. Now, here's a follow-up question for our audience. If you're using a measure in your practice, which one of these do you use most often? And it may or may not be on here. We have CDI, the PASI, the Rapid 3, PROMIS, some combination of measures. Give us your candid answer. All right, so let's dive into the clinical stuff. So Stanley, you and I have been practicing rheumatology for a couple of years.
A few years.
And so how do patients with moderate to active rheumatoid arthritis present in practice? And what's your kind of just like initial thinking of, you know, how you're going to start crafting therapy in this group?
Well, we're fortunate that these days patients are presenting earlier in their disease processes. So we're seeing patients who we're trying to get into the rheumatologist as quickly as possible so that we can intervene and prevent them from progressing to moderate to severe disease, deforming disease, increased disability. So many of these patients are getting in within just a few days or a few weeks to us or to physician extenders, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, so we can begin to treat them. The good news is our treatment paradigm is much better than it was when I started practice in the dark ages in 1980. Back then we had empirical therapies we stole from other disciplines. Now over the last 30 years we've developed targeted therapies, starting first with methotrexate, which we did take from our oncology colleagues. But in 1998 the first biologics were approved for the treatment of inflammatory arthritis, and that has led to us being able to manage almost two-thirds or more of our patients quite effectively. And now we have targeted immune modulators, small molecules that are as effective as biologics. So things are, it's a lot more fun to be a rheumatologist, and it's a lot more fun to take care of patients because we have so many options for them.
So, I mean, that is a rapidly changing terrain. So Eileen, now you haven't been doing this quite as long as Stanley and I.
I'm surprised.
You get the child award here on this stage. Right. But, you know, even in your career, I think you've seen changes in how we interprofessionally work together. It's not a one-on-one sport anymore.
Yeah, when I first started 15 years ago, that's when the biologics and the targeted therapies were just first starting to come out.
Exciting times.
And so we are certainly busier now than we were back then. And we do work much more closely with the multidisciplinary team, which include, of course, the rheumatologist, advanced providers, nurses, social workers, physical therapists, and the orthopedic doctors. And of course, our primary goal is to prevent radiographic damage, or at least try to slow it down, and also to reduce hospitalizations and just to get the best quality outcomes that we can so that our patients have the best quality of life. And, you know, nurses in particular, their role has expanded, again, since when I first started. Now they need to really understand these targeted therapies, be able to educate their patients about them, monitor side effects. With all the insurance issues these days with the prior authorizations and certainly assessing our patients for adherence. I mean, their hands are full. And, you know, some nurses are even taking on doing disease activity assessments nowadays. And then, of course, we have the advanced providers, which, you know, they can assess and advise and educate and treat and manage their own panel of patients. And also, you know, we can manage comorbidities. And then we have our social workers. So when we have psychological, you know, issues that we're identifying, we have them to refer to, which is very important for adherence. In fact, it's sometimes the primary reason.
We're going to get into some of that and try to talk about how we dig some of these needs of the patients out during the course of you know, what we're trying to make is a succinct and a highly efficient a visit. So with that background, let's drill in on learning objective number one about aligning treatment decisions with recommendations from the ACR and actually other organizations as well about this treat-to-target concept, which is kind of ensconced in the past decade. So in your practice, what does treat-to-target mean when caring for patients with rheumatoid arthritis? It's a question. Just give us your best answer. Does that mean we treat to low disease activity as measured by a rapid 3? Does that mean that we achieve clinical remission by some metric or definition? Is it merely the lack of symptoms as defined by the patient, so-called patient global? Or is it, you know, our kind of, you know, gestalt of what's going on, the physician global? Let's get an answer for that right now. So, Eileen, this is a very complicated area. I'm going to ask you to kind of succinctly just give us a 30,000-foot view. In the clinic, we have this list of validated disease activity measures. And these are complicated, and they all have pieces and parts to them. You know, what are the shared features, and what are the things that you actually gravitate to doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as you can see, there are several here. And some of them, a patient would just fill out a questionnaire, basically, and it talks about activities of daily living, essentially. And others, you would do a joint count of, like, your 28 joints of swollen and tender joints. And some of them, you would incorporate lab values such as the SED rate and the CRP, but the good news is that they're all equally effective in measuring disease activity.
Okay, so mm-hmm. you know, again, not to sound like dinosaurs here, but this was really not part of the practice a generation ago.
No,
it was just kind of the physician's global assessment, patient's global assessment. So now the patient is much more actively involved. I'd like to show you a picture at the Cleveland Clinic of, you know, how this flow of information goes. So sitting in the waiting room is Colleen, a nice patient of mine with rheumatoid arthritis. So we have a number of patient-reported outcomes that are electronically linked and will be transmitted to our EMR. So by the time that I see her, I'll have all of this in front of me. It can be done on this pad. Comes in a few minutes early for, or about a third of our patients are actually doing this at home. And I know, you know, this sounds a little ivory towerish, perhaps sitting there, but this can be done in paper, and the technology is getting easier and easier. So this just makes the point that, you know, a visit has a little bit more complexity, but if you think about it and kind of lay this out, I think that I'll show you that this information can be valuable mm-hmm. in the doctor-patient and the team approach, I should say. All right, so I mentioned that we are using these PROMIS scales at the Cleveland Clinic. And just to give the background here, PROMIS scales are developed by the National Institutes of Health with your tax dollars and my tax dollars. And they're available free to everybody. Mm-hmm. And you can be done on a paper form, or they're computerized versions. Now, they do all this stuff, and you might be wondering, like, well, what's the point? And, you know, it's nice to have it. Are you just satisfying, you know, MACRA regulations for your billing? But no, I think it's more than that. What we do show here is that we give the patient the option, would you like to review your own data? And most patients do. And as you can see here, you've got a couple speedometers. Here's your physical health. Here's your mental health. You know, these are written on, you know, you get a T-score, so you can tell in the population, you know, you're in the top or you're in the bottom. And this is readily understandable to a patient. Now, let me give you a little sample of what patients might be thinking.
I'm hearing more and more of patients saying I was crying and the doctor just got up and walked out of the office. Mental health is very rarely covered.
You know, this is difficult for me to hear this. And I think that, you know, all of us, you know, we train a lot about feeling tender and swollen joints, but in our training, you know, role modeling empathy is really important, and I take that very seriously. But I think that some of these tools can actually help us engage with this. So let's go back to our patient. Hey, Colleen, it's really great to see you today.
Thanks for coming in. Thank you. Good to see you, too.
You know, I'd like to start off by reviewing some of these outcome measures you just did in the waiting room for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been doing so good with your rheumatoid arthritis.
Thank you.
I'm looking at your disease activity score right now. Your Rapid 3 shows that you're having a lot of pain. Your PROMIS score here shows that it's really interfering with your day-to-day activities. Mm-hmm. But I got to ask you something.
Sure.
That, you know, for the first time I'm seeing something on here I haven't seen before. It looks like you're a little depressed today.
Well, you know, it's really hard to talk about. I'm going through a divorce after 25 years of marriage, and, you know, I have 5 kids, and it's just on my mind all the time. And so it makes it kind of hard sometimes, you know, to get through the day.
Well, thanks for sharing that with me. And you know, we got a lot to do today. I'm going to look at your joints. They haven't looked too bad as I've been talking mm-hmm. to you. And I think we have a number of things to talk about today. And I'm going to show you these scores right now. So you can
great.
Take a peek at them and see for yourself. But we're going to work on all of this together, okay?
That sounds great. It's so nice to have someone on my side, because these days I don't always feel like anybody is.
Thanks. So with that... you know, kind of real life example here.
I think it's very important that you're using these questionnaires and getting these elements investigated, because this allows you an entree to discuss that with the patient. One of the phenomena we as rheumatologists and extenders always mm-hmm. talk about is the patient whose joints look so good, but their patient global is so high. This is a way of objectifying that information, allowing you to have that discussion mm-hmm. about mental health and depression and so forth. And then one other thing, as a clinical trialist, we determined years ago that patient-reported outcomes were less susceptible to placebo effect. They're really more of an objective measure of how a patient's doing. So it's great to see, as we have seen, the movement to get PROs moved up in the paradigm of how we assess our patients.
You know, a little truth-telling here is that, you know, 2 years ago when we first started to incorporate these in the practice, I was not initially a big fan. I thought, like, this is one more thing I got to do,
right.
But I've turned into a zealot, and I'm all in to this. And I think that's just a small example, but mm-hmm. I think it really helps create that bond. So let me ask our audience another question. When you develop a treatment plan in patients with moderate to severe RA, what most drives your treatment decision? And here are the choices: ACR guidelines, what the insurance company tells you to do, patient preference, symptoms that you feel that you want to target, what's going on in the formulary to dictate that, or is it something else, and so it's none of the above. So we'll tuck that away for a while, and now I'd like to kind of turn to the treatment guidelines themselves. This is kind of a onerous thing. You say you have these treatment guidelines that come out, they're long, they're complicated. And are they practical? Do we put enough weight into them, too much weight? How do they affect the practice in the best of practices?
Well, I think they're basically the guidelines are recommendations, whether they're ACR, EULAR, or other national societies. And so they set the framework for what we do. I mean, clearly each patient is individual, has their comorbidities, other issues that will modify what you do for the patient. But again, there is a roadmap based on objective data, evidence-based medicine, that sets the pathway for how we approach patients with early rheumatoid arthritis or patients who have established disease. And using markers of low disease activity or higher risk patients, some patients who are seropositive, mm-hmm. patients who have erosive damage, patients who have multiple swollen tender joint counts, elevated acute phase reactants, it helps us to use this framework to stratify our patients and dictate therapy. You know, there's still the art of medicine, but it's very helpful to have these evidence-based recommendations to guide us not only for how we treat the patient, but how do we handle the patient who has comorbidities, chronic hepatitis C, things of that nature, which make our day more difficult in coming up with the best plans for them.
Eileen, how about from the advanced practitioner perspective?
Yes, for the advanced practitioners and for the nurses as well, it's an algorithm. It's something we can follow, certainly, so we know that we need to bring them back and get on top of the treatments. But, you know, sometimes, like Dr. Cohen was just saying, it's not always doable, not always practical with comorbidities. If you have an infected patient, for example, and you can't be so aggressive. And there are times that patients just like where they're at, and sometimes it takes a lot of management just to get them on one drug, and you kind of have to work closely with them.
I think we're going to come back to that patient choice thing, which is really important in this whole algorithmic approach. You know, we talk a lot about disease activity, but the quality side is important as well. So we have some results coming back on that question. So the top choice of our group, not the majority, but about a quarter, say low disease activity is their primary goal. Well, there's a bunch of rheumatologists out there.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's what we're does that surprise you or comfort you or?
That doesn't surprise. I mean, if a patient has structural damage, it's going to be very hard to achieve remission. So certainly it's in the EULAR and their recommendations for treat to target. Obviously, our goal is remission, modifying therapy as necessary, but certainly low disease activity is acceptable, and it's wonderful if you're able to achieve sustained low disease activity.
Mm-hmm. So show us how this treat to target thing actually works.
Well, what you know, basically, it's been a phenomenon that first came to out and was exciting with the Ticora study, and then followed by others, the BEST study, which we'll discuss briefly. But it's measuring disease activity and acting on that disease activity. If a patient doesn't meet a threshold for remission or low disease activity, modifying their therapy in such a way so that you can improve the outcomes for the patient. And then continuing to monitor them over some period of time to determine benefits. So the BEST study was one of the great examples of a treat-to-target study, again in the Netherlands, early disease, 6 to 7 months of disease, 500 patients. It was a strategy study looking at DMARD monotherapy, step-up combination therapy to triple therapy, high-dose steroids plus low-dose methotrexate and sulfasalazine, or high-dose methotrexate and infliximab. Again, a physician extender, evaluated the patient every 3 months for years with the goal of a DAS44 less than 2.4, which was low disease activity. What it showed, no matter what strategy you used, if you did act on elevated disease activity, the majority of the patients achieved low disease activity, and in this study at 5 years, 48% remission. Slight differences early on with higher dose steroids and biologics. So the European model, treat to target, dramatically improved patient outcomes.
And my understanding of certainly the clinical trials and how these things were done efficiently was that the determinant of disease activity was by and large not determined by a physician. It was kind of a cold metrologist, as they call them over there. So that adds a kind of a twist here that, you know, most of us don't have metrologists in our practice. And, I was reading Jack Kush's Room Now very recently, and there was a pretty heated debate going on about treat to target in the pages of Room Now. And a number of people said, you know, I aspire to that just as a routine part of my practice. There's some interesting data that recently came out. Stanley, you want to summarize some of that for us?
Right, so the Corona Registry did a study. That's Corona's an observational registry with about 500 patients at multiple practice sites throughout the United States. And they had cluster randomization to treat to target, where patients were seen every 3 months, but even up to monthly, if disease activity was CDI was greater than 10 with moderate to high disease, compared to a usual care, where doctors could do what they wanted to do to manage the patients. So what their data showed, at least in North America, was that the percentage of patients who escalated their therapy was no different between the patients who received treat to target or usual care. And what they showed is the number of patients who were in low disease activity was no different, which was the primary efficacy outcome for the full data set. Secondary efficacy outcome was for the patients who remained on study. So what it suggested to me was that North American rheumatology has been practicing treat to target for years, which I've always thought we were. If a patient is ill and not doing well, we look at their CDI, we look at their SDI. I don't use the DAS, it's too hard to calculate without having the lab data, and we modify therapy. In a system like the European therapy theater or the rest of the world where patients may not see a physician for a year or six months, a rheumatologist, I think treat to target made a tremendous difference, but I think we've already been doing it.
I'm going to go off track here for a second. I just want to ask you, how do you feel in your practice about getting people to low disease activity versus remission, and what do you actually do?
Well, it depends on the individual patient. If I'm talking about a patient with 10 or 15 years of disease, remission is not even something that I'm looking at and the criteria that we're using. So low disease activity I'm pleased with. And remission for a younger patient is a target. Early RA we know is much more susceptible to response to therapy. So we're targeting remission in those patients. And as we've talked offline with Eileen, I mean, some of our patients are happy where they are. Mm-hmm. And trying to prod them to do more is not always an easy discussion. Even in the European studies, we know that about a third of patients choose not to escalate therapies when their numbers suggest they should.
You know, it's interesting, just to bring this up, some recent work by some of our Portuguese colleagues have made, drawn distinctions between people who are in remission versus low disease activity based on their global response only. In other words, good joints, but as we said before, the high global. And those people, you know, that is a special population that you and I and Eileen understand. And these are likely not people that you can just beat down into remission. And this is where you need to understand what some of the other dynamics are in their pain amplification or quality of life issues. So I think this is a nuance, and it's very important in training programs that, you know, trainees understand that.
Yeah, I know some Army patients say they're just so used to the pain that they feel, you know, that, you know, even if they go down a little bit, they're very happy with that.
They've adapted.
Yeah.
Well, and some other work recently said that, you know, we don't assess personality types. The personality type is huge.
Absolutely.
You know, how much you can, are willing or capable of coping with. So anyway, a lot of really interesting parts for this. So in summary, measuring disease activity in some way, shape, or form, should play a major role in impacting decisions to modify therapy. This certainly is something that we have to do to meet the metrics that are given to us by payers. Also, I would say that treat to target certainly has resulted in improved patient outcomes, at least in the years preceding and leading up to the present time, largely in Europe, but has set a bar for us. And then lastly, some of this interesting data coming out suggests that maybe this does not translate to all systems around the world, and maybe U.S. rheumatology, while it is under-manpowered, once patients get in, the care seems to be pretty comparable. So let's move on to learning objective number two, and we'll focus a little bit about some oral therapies and get into these JAK inhibitors in this very exciting new area. So we're really lucky here to have Dr. Cohen. He's He's one of the leading opinion leaders on these small molecules coming out. And I have to say, it's getting complicated. I mean, we've had tofacitinib for a number of years and kind of get this. Now we have a number of drugs. They're all hard to pronounce. They all look like they kind of work on overlying pathways. And how did we get here? And help sort us out a little bit for us.
Well, the good news is we've arrived to some degree. Certainly for someone who started practice in 1979, we were in the dark ages of what we had then. We still have our conventional synthetic DMARDs that you mentioned, methotrexate, still the hallmark of initial therapy along with other conventional synthetic DMARDs. The biologics revolutionized the treatment of RA, where we can now provide relief to about two-thirds of patients. And now we have the targeted synthetic disease modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. For years, when I would speak or talk or write, I would talk about the Holy Grail would be finding a pill that would do what biologics could do. And so we're here. We now have therapies that can do that. So we'll discuss briefly the benefits of these therapies as well as the role of monotherapy. So, about 30% of our patients choose not to take combination therapy. About 30% take biologic monotherapy. Many different reasons, adverse reaction, just unwillingness or noncompliance, or the other phenomenon, we're always looking at reducing therapy. Mm-hmm. If a patient's in remission, can we withdraw their therapy? There's data to support monotherapy efficacy from trials, observational registries, and I'll show you just a little bit of that data in the next few slides.
Can I interject here? So
yes.
If we talk about this monotherapy group, and we talked a little bit about methotrexate to begin with, Eileen, what do you hear when patients are not in harmony with their methotrexate?
Oh, they complain of GI symptoms and losing their hair and ulcers in their mouth. Sometimes we see anemia with that as well. So, you know, when we start the methotrexate, we'll always start them with folic acid. You know, I'll always explain how they deplete that, and that's what we have to get back in their system. And sometimes they'll switch to sub-Q. Rather than keeping them on oral to get them straight.
But, you know, back in the day, you know, when we didn't have biologics, you used methotrexate and you used it on everybody. And, I've seen patients taking, antiemetics and dextromethorphan and
right.
things trying to, switch the day of the week to do this. So, you know, particularly those of us that grew up with this, many of us are kind of inured to the adverse events. But, you know, if you really start talking to people about this, I think it's a good third of people. These are not side effects that I would prefer to have if I was taking that drug.
No, I agree. I mean, mm-hmm. I think 20-30% of patients mm-hmm. would prefer to be on something else if they could, if we could convince the insurance companies early on in the disease to allow us to do that.
It's a big deal. So, all right. So then, if we're lopping methotrexate off, can these other drugs be used in monotherapy? What's the data?
Right. So just there's many, many different studies. Just show you a few of these. So this was the premier study, which compared adalimumab monotherapy to methotrexate. Plus adalimumab to methotrexate monotherapy. And what this slide represents is combination therapy was better as far as the ACR responses and also EULAR responses as well. However, adalimumab was, as monotherapy, was effective in the short term over the 2 to 3 years of this study. And it also was superior to methotrexate in preventing structure progression, structure radiographic damage. Additionally, tocilizumab has been looked at in monotherapy, and this was in patients who were naive to methotrexate. And you can see here, looking at the percent of patients on the y-axis and looking at ACR responses, IV tocilizumab 8 milligram per kilogram was superior to methotrexate with ACR responses, EULAR responses, and DAS remission. So again, both of these demonstrating that biologic therapies were as good as or better than methotrexate. Tofacitinib has also been looked at as an early RA. This was the oral start study. And tofacitinib 5 and 10 milligrams BID monotherapy was compared to methotrexate. The ACR 70 at month 6, the primary endpoint along with prevention of radiographic progression, was achieved by tofacitinib 5 and 10 milligrams and was statistically superior to methotrexate, again demonstrating that this target immune modulator was better than methotrexate in early RA.
So just to throw this in, I mean, this is an oral drug.
Right.
This, beats up methotrexate in head-to-head competition, but any of these guidelines, it's kind of shoved down there.
I think it's been in that place because it's a newer therapy, and we'll see with the new updated guidelines how well they address this data. I think they need to address this data and give us as clinical rheumatologists and healthcare professionals the option of using this drug in a patient who has a worse prognosis. That's the one thing we're limited by now. When we do pre-authorization, our voice is not heard, and that patients who have a worse prognosis should be treated more aggressively.
I agree. So so now we have a number of other up-and-coming small molecules. This is a complex landscape. You know, how do you sort them out in your head, and what are they looking like, knowing that none of them are available in the U.S. at the present time?
Well, just one other snippet of data before we talk about some of the other small molecules. So this is a study with tofacitinib, the oral strategy study, which also looked at tofacitinib monotherapy compared to tofacitinib plus methotrexate or adalimumab plus methotrexate, and it was a non-inferiority study. And what they demonstrated is all three strategies worked. ACR20, ACR50, and 70 responses are shown here. Tofacitinib monotherapy did not achieve non-inferiority, but again, it was very clinically effective. And again, just supports what we know. Combination therapy with conventional synthetic DMARD is probably slightly better than biologic monotherapy, but when those drugs are contraindicated, this is a reasonable treatment approach. So, moving on.
You know, I just point out, as we were discussing earlier, you know, that monotherapy while statistically not achieving non-inferiority, the vast majority of those people do okay, right? The trick is figuring out who those okay people are.
Right, so there's a clinical trial ongoing now that you can look up on clinicaltrials.gov looking at taking patients on tofacitinib plus methotrexate. Those who achieve low disease activity, the methotrexate is removed in a blinded fashion. So it's going to give us a lot of answers about what we might be able to do. And I suspect that we'll find that 30 to 40% of our patients who are on combination can go off the methotrexate and continue in low disease activity.
So let's get into some of these other JAKs.
Right, so other Janus kinase inhibitors are under development. Baricitinib is approved throughout the world except not in the United States. And there was a recent arthritis advisory committee that looked at baricitinib 2 and 4 milligrams, and we are waiting to see how the FDA takes that advice. This was a study looking at baricitinib monotherapy 4 milligrams or combination with methotrexate compared to methotrexate monotherapy, again in early RA. And shown here is the ACR responses and where baricitinib clinically was better than methotrexate monotherapy, mirroring the tofacitinib data. Additionally, other JAK inhibitors are under development. Filgotinib, which is upadacitinib, but another one, JAK inhibitor that's under development, are preferential JAK1 inhibitors, at least in various enzymatic or blood assays. This was a phase 2 study, the Darwin study, a dose-ranging study looking at 100 and 200 milligrams daily of filgotinib compared to methotrexate plus placebo, and this was background methotrexate with filgotinib. And you can see, again, that the JAK inhibitors were superior to continuing methotrexate alone. So it's exciting. What we wait now is there any clinical differentiation of these molecules? Will there be different? This does not seem to be any difference in efficacy. They're all very effective. They're as effective as biologic therapies, parenteral therapies. The question is, will there be differentiation on safety, adverse events? And that we don't know yet.
Would you like to just kind of just give us a magic minute on class safety of these drugs?
Right, so I think there's a number of class effects that occurs. Certainly, we're seeing hyperlipidemia in these patients, neutropenia. These JAKs all inhibit IL-6, and similar to what we see with IL-6 inhibitors. As far as laboratories, we're seeing modest LFT elevations in some patients. Lymphopenia can occur. And then, since it also inhibits type 1 interferons, NK cells are impacted, we're seeing an increased risk of zoster. There's a controversial issue now, which has not been well ferreted out, which is the concern about thromboembolic phenomenon and whether there is actually a class effect or there's some concerns about there may be an increased risk. And I think we're too early in the game to know.
These are serious medications, and they need to be treated as I treat them as biologics in my practice, at least framing the
absolutely
risks. But a great addition to our armamentarium. So let me summarize point number two. So Biologics, when combined with methotrexate or other synthetic DMARDs, generally are superior to biologic monotherapy, but we put an asterisk that many of these patients on monotherapy do quite well because biologic monotherapy inhibits structural damage, but just doesn't make it quite as robustly as combo. Infliximab, adalimumab treatment was associated with anti-drug antibodies. This is something that we really haven't talked about, and I think that when you're using these drugs, you need to know which biologics you're using. Some are far more immunogenic than others, but methotrexate and other synthetic DMARDs are good buffers against that, and another reason to use them in combination. Finally, for patients who are methotrexate intolerant or have other comorbidities or for a variety of reasons, biologic monotherapy is appropriate in those settings. So with that, we're going to now segue to our final learning objective, and that is about integrating many of these principles of multidisciplinary care and team approach and digital health tools to improve adherence, patient outcomes, and actually patient satisfaction, something that we really haven't talked about very much, but it is important to our practices and to our institutions. So, Eileen, can you elaborate a little bit on, you know, how you think that advanced practitioners can optimally improve the quality of care in practice settings?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, we can have our own panels of patients and assess and treat and diagnose patients. But the reality is that only 25% of the practices are using advanced providers effectively. And it's a big problem because a lot of patients have a long wait time, up to a couple of months, sometimes before they can get in to see a rheumatologist. And in the days now when we're very big on diagnosing early, you know, this is an issue. And I just see us as working together with the rheumatologist to come up with a better way to use us, you know, effectively and efficiently.
I couldn't mm-hmm. have said it better or buy into it more. I will throw this out since we will be talking about wellness. That is a great area of interest of ours in our clinic, and you know, the question of, you know, we all want our patients to be well, no mm-hmm. matter how you define it. Just say, you know, wellness is, you know, when a person's life is well lived, we recognize that. When people are not well, we recognize that too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we would all like to be engaged in talking about smoking and mm-hmm. diet and exercise and weight loss and stress reduction. We're busy people, but I think that this is a fabulous way mm-hmm. for interprofessionally relating. So I have a little mm-hmm. video clip of my nurse practitioner, Betsy, who you know. Yes. Well, who's, I always say, world's best nurse practitioner, but maybe co-best since you're here on stage.
She's awesome.
Let's take a look at a typical encounter.
So, Alex, it sounds like the medicine's working pretty well. Your joint pain is a lot better. You have a little bit less morning stiffness, a little better activity tolerance. We'll just keep monitoring you, make sure things are going well. Are there any questions that you had?
I don't think so. I think the medicine's been working pretty well. I don't have a whole lot of time to exercise. You know, I have a full-time job. I've got small kids. I'm just wondering if there's anything else that I can do, maybe at home, or if you have any tips for just keeping my health in good shape.
We absolutely do, and I'm glad you asked. We have these sort of, we call them the four pillars of immunologic health. So you have an autoimmune disease, and it would be fantastic if you could, you know, from your end, just sort of do the whatever you can to keep your immune system happy. So it's sort of like nutrition, getting good quality sleep, activity, and it doesn't have to be, you know, structured exercise where you're going to the gym all the time. I know you don't have time for that. And then some sort of mind-body health activity like meditation, yoga, something like that. So it's a lot to go over. It's a lot to absorb. We do have a little booklet that one of the physicians up here put together about maintaining a healthy immune system. So you can start with this and see what you think and let us know what's working for you, what isn't, and we can just make it an ongoing sort of process.
Great, thanks.
So, yeah, that's what happens in our clinic, and we actually have, in each room, we have a video monitor that has a constant feed of healthy recipes, tips about staying vaccinated so they can engage us, little factoids about exercise and stress and their disease, and patients will bring it up. And if they're sitting in there, it's a good thing to do. So
I agree. I mean, and the one thing that the physician extenders bring is there's no way we can meet the demand of the patients that we have coming to us now. And the model in the future is going to be greater utilization of NPs and PAs. And I think to achieve what you guys have been able to do at the Cleveland Clinic, which is so hard for us to do in a community setting, you're going to need these types of people that can spend more time with our patients to improve adherence and to make sure that the patients achieve quality outcomes. I think that with the overrun healthcare system that we have now, we need all men on deck, all people on deck.
That's right,
all
people, the whole team.
All people
yeah,
on deck, excuse
absolutely.
Me. Yeah.
So, Eileen, speaking of that, I know you were part of a working group that with the Arthritis Foundation developing some toolkits for providers to incorporate in their practice that hopefully would improve quality of care. You want to just give us a magic minute on that?
One tool is about trying to identify patients early, and it was mainly for primary care providers as well as nurses. And it's just a quick questionnaire if you thought your patient might have inflammatory arthritis, and if they scored high on it, then there was an educational video that actually taught how to do the tender and swollen joint count, and then from there, if they had some, then you would plug it into the EULAR classification criteria, which helps us diagnose, early RA, and then the whole idea was then to send them along to an early RA clinic as soon as possible. So I have seen it work well in the clinic I work in. Actually, the nurses in ortho clinic come up to me and they're like, okay, I found somebody, we're going to refer them over to our clinic, and we have, they have, and they're proud of that,
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So, the Arthritis Foundation in particular has been really strong advocate of, what they've referred to as self-efficacy. People who have a disease that can kind of take some responsibility and take charge of their own thing. Stan, what your perspective? I know you've been involved in some of this work and patient-reported outcomes and looking at some of this. You think this is an important part of the practice?
Oh, I think it is an important part of practice, and it's something we probably don't do well enough. I think we're light years of where we were 10 years ago. I mean, we collect patient-reported outcomes. We do CDIs. We interact with our patients and act on that data. And so I think it's improved the quality of care that we deliver. But as I said earlier, we need the Eileens of the world. We need all the help that we can get to because we're going from one room to the next room, and we need people to interface with our patients to help them.
So these are some data that have been put out very recently that just essentially tell us what we're discussing
saying.
Here.
Yeah.
That if you really put goal setting and self-monitoring as part of the practice, that you want patients to engage in that, that they'll improve their knowledge, skills, and confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we think will happen is that they'll be more adherent. Be able to appreciate warning signs of complications, and be a better part of the team. Mm-hmm. Patients have to be part of that the team as well.
Absolutely.
So now let's segue here a little bit, and I want to talk about virtual visits. So this is something new. All right, so. Rheumatology, I think it, within the spectrum of internal medicine, we are at the bottom in terms of workforce adequacy, and it's not going to get better. You were telling us some figures. What was the figure you had that you told us about?
The demand in 2030 is going to be 138% for rheumatologists.
Subtract me from that.
I just heard that recently.
But it's serious. So how are we going to meet this? So, mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about advanced practitioners, mm-hmm. and you see new patients, and mm-hmm. our advanced practitioners see new patients. But there's also an issue of distribution of rheumatologists. They're not, there's certainly more rheumatologists in northeastern Ohio than there are in central Ohio, right. or western Ohio or areas like that. So we have introduced a new form of visit that is a virtual visit that does not require patients to drive, 50 or 100 miles. They don't have to park the car. They don't have to come into town. This is and people who often have rheumatic diseases are, maybe not moving as fast. And we have an older population as well. And we also have busy people that, mm-hmm. Probably we'd like to hear from them, but, mm-hmm. They're just not getting off of work this fast. So mm-hmm. Dr. Rochelle Rosian at the Cleveland Clinic has taken this task and developed it. Now I'll show you one of her virtual visits.
Hi, Mr. Smith. It's Dr. Rosian. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for doing this virtual visit with me today. I hope this works for you.
Yeah, this is great. I was having a hard time getting back to the house, so I just decided to do it from the office.
Okay, good. So this is a routine follow-up visit for your rheumatoid arthritis. Is that right?
Yes.
Let me get to your chart and open things up. What would you like to talk about today?
I've just been having some shoulder pain lately.
Shoulder pain?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Anything else besides the shoulder pain?
No, it's mostly the shoulder pain that's I've been concerned about.
All right. So before we get to a little bit more about the shoulder pain, I want to review your medications just like we would do if you were actually in the room with me.
So if I look at your med list here, it looks like you're taking naproxen, which is your anti-inflammatory.
Yes.
Okay. And I also see that you're on tofacitinib twice a day for the rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes.
Okay. And then when I reviewed your chart before I logged on with you, you had mentioned the last time that you were interested in maybe trying to consolidate your medications to once a day or getting rid of some of the medicines.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. So let's have a look and go into the shoulder and wrist pain a little bit more, and then maybe we'll be able to simplify your medical regimen a little bit.
Okay.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your shoulder pain?
It's just I feel it with movement.
Okay.
If I go to move my shoulder, I feel a sharp pain.
Okay. So is it when you're moving your shoulder up over your head or more to the front?
More up over my head.
Okay. And is that more during the day or at night?
At night, if I'm trying to get comfortable, I feel that sharp pain when I try to move my hand.
Okay. All right. So let's see if we can't see what's going on a little bit.
So this is your left shoulder, Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Okay. And is it hurting more in the front of the shoulder or more in the back, by towards the neck?
More in the front of the shoulder.
More in the front of the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And have you noticed that more when you're doing things up over your head or out in front of you?
Yeah, mostly up over my head.
Mm-hmm. Is there any numbness or tingling with that?
No numbness or tingling, no.
Okay, good. Let me get that down. So I'm documenting, just like you were here in place with me. So let's try and do a few motions with that. So can you still get your hands up behind your head like we do?
Yeah.
Show me that. Okay. Yeah. So you're feeling that?
Yeah, I can still feel it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how about this way, behind?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You can feel it in there, but you're still able to do that all the way. It just hurts a lot.
Yeah, I can still do it.
Okay. And then are you having any problems with your elbow or down in the wrist at all?
No, a little wrist pain in my other wrist, but nothing with that shoulder, no.
Nothing with that shoulder. And is the wrist, can you show me your wrist?
Sure.
Pull it up in front of the camera, a little bit higher up.
I can't see it. Oh, that's too close. There you go. Is it red? And how about the other way? Yeah, so it doesn't look too swollen to me today.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can make a fist for me?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, that sounds good. All right.
Looks like your RA part is okay. I'm kind of concerned that this is more of a rotator cuff sort of thing. So let's go through your follow-up, you know, assessment plan so we can figure out what you're going to go home with, okay?
Okay.
So that was just a little snippet of a typical virtual visit. And obviously, I think a seasoned clinician can use a virtual visit, and you know when it's not right,
right.
And getting the sense. But in a visit like this, you know, this saved Mr. Smith from having to leave work, got adequate follow-up. We can put in his labs. He can go to a laboratory to see mm-hmm. it. So mm-hmm. We think that in it's one answer to manpower shortage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're not using technology of that level at this point, but just with the electronic medical records. So we get 10 to 15 emails every day. The patients can attach mm-hmm. photographs to the email.
Absolutely.
So I think it's made us all better physicians, better caregivers.
Yeah, I think it's also helpful with follow-up patients that you know really well.
In particular.
Yeah,
no, I agree.
Yeah.
So another supplementary tool for helping our patients achieve their treatment goal is this digital health coaching world. We're very excited to share with you one such tool called PacHealth. Let's watch this brief video and introduce you to PacHealth and its potential benefits for our patients.
One of the biggest problems that we have in healthcare is chronic disease management. You know, behavior modification is the key to all of it. It's not just enough to tell people what's wrong with them. You've got to give them the tools so that they can change their behavior. The other providers in the healthcare system don't have the time, don't have the background to really follow up with people and see that they are doing what they're supposed to do. So that's what PacHealth does, is they fill that void.
Here's how it works. We partner every patient, whom we call members, with a dedicated health advisor. And that health advisor brings to bear a team to help that member achieve their health goals. Our health advising is all digital and remote. It's on a HIPAA-secured platform, and we record all of those critical points outside of the doctor's office.
We don't get to spend as much time.
Hey, we're pleased to offer this excellent digital health coaching tool to you and the clinical audience at no cost for the first 100 patients to enroll. So please enroll your patients soon. Use the promo code here, RACMEO, and you'll also receive monthly reports on your patient's progress, which I think is pretty cool because then that gets to see what their wellness behavior and their behavioral changes are. So, Stan, Eileen, I think that today's discussion was useful in a number of areas. We've uncovered a number of things. I think there's some areas of need where we have to do some changing. Anything that you'd like to take home here about, where we are today in treatment of rheumatoid and related diseases?
For the team approach, I think that we would do very good, much better, if we worked together as a team. We would get a lot more accomplished. And also, I think it would be great if more practices would use advanced practitioners to the top of their license. Those are my take-home points.
give the Rheumatology Nursing Society's big shout-out.
Yeah,
Well, I think things are changing. I think the discussion we had, certainly the therapeutics have improved. We're mm-hmm. very happy about that. But I think this whole digital coaching, we already have adopted in our practice the use of physician extenders, and I think that it's a necessity. Mm-hmm. It's not an option anymore. We're going to all work together as a team to try to provide as many patients quality care as we can.
Mm-hmm.
But I am excited about this virtual rheumatology mm-hmm. as well as the digital coaching to see where that takes us.
So I want to remind our audience that we have created a useful downloadable resource that includes the slides we presented today and some additional slides for your review. So go to the website, cmeoutfitters.com, for a comprehensive list of clinical resources, outcomes, research news, additional educational activities for both providers and patients, and really a whole lot more. keep an eye out for the Rheumatology Hub, where videos we shared today will be posted to use with your team. So thank you again for joining us for the presentation portion of our program. And I ask you now to stick around for this after the show segment, where we will answer your questions and address clinical barriers that you may perceive and identify. I hope you'll be able to integrate some of the strategies we talked about today in your own practice for patients with rheumatoid arthritis. So stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes. I heard we have a lot of questions. All right. Boy, we have a lot to chit-chat about here, you guys. I think we were successful. So let's just kind of, we'll start here. So the ACR guidelines, in the opinion of this pollster here, are rather out of date, and in reality often are a barrier to get patients medications that we think that they need. I think we actually raised this. Do you have any idea when they're going to be updated?
Beginning now. The process is starting next month. I'm actually going to be part of the expert panel, and so, you know, again, it'll take a year or so, but it's the process is underway.
It's a very rigorous process.
Yeah.
You guys do a lot of work, and so it does take time. But I do appreciate that. And we actually raised that issue that, you know, I think that today we look at kinase inhibitors not as the last option. We think that they would like to see them more liberally.
Well, unfortunately, they utilize the evidence they have at the time.
Right.
And it's
right.
Evidence-based. And one of the criticisms is it's so evidence-based that, you know, a lot of the recommendations they make are based on very little evidence, and are they're not willing to make a recommendation. So I think the updated recommendations have a good chance of being vastly different. We'll see.
So there was a question about the virtual visits that people seem to like. So yeah, I and the question is it reimbursable, and how does it go? I mean, that's a very, very, very important point. So I don't want to speak out of turn about the exact cost, but payers are now just coming to bear on the reality of virtual visits. So at the present time, we charge cash, credit card for these, and I think it's somewhere around $50 or $60, something like that. And you can go to the Cleveland Clinic website and check on it. You know, when you think about it, if you live 100 miles away and you're going to drive up there, or you're going to try to take time off of work, I don't know what your copay would be. We found that this to be a very sweet spot, and these virtual visits are being done across our system in multiple departments. So I think it's a, at that cost, it's
I'm just curious. So
realistic.
if someone does a virtual visit and they don't feel like they've been effective, the healthcare professional, do they recommend that they come in for a visit? Does that happen?
We have to ask Dr. Rosian. I'm not doing a virtual visit.
All right.
I just watch it.
Or your question, how do you give the virtual steroid shot?
Right.
Well, I mean, that's when you know that, you know, as I say, a seasoned physician, somebody, you know, Rochelle would know that, like, you know, Mr. Smith, you're going to have to come in and
I would
get
so.
My hands on that shoulder, and we're going to have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But he was kind of getting by, and, you know, call me if it gets worse, or email me. These are all people that are tech savvy and are on my chart, et cetera.
All right,
so now let's just throw out something we haven't talked about, but what is your opinion on biosimilars? Who's saving the money?
Well, biosimilar, I've been very much involved in biosimilar clinical trials and published and so forth. And biosimilars are as effective as originator biologics. Clearly, in the worldwide system, non-U.S., where the governments often purchase the drugs, it's going to be a tremendous cost saving to the healthcare system. In North America, with our fragmented, very peculiar system, it's not clear who's going to save the money. We'd like to believe, we are told that our premiums are increased every time patients take biologics. That cost is spread across all members in a plan. So you would hope eventually to see maybe lesser growth in our premiums, but I don't ever expect that to occur. So the point's well taken. I'm not sure what's going to happen in the United States. I have no fear about using biosimilars, and I think using biosimilars that are cheaper as original drugs is appropriate. I'm not excited about non-medical substitution where I'm told what to do in a patient who's doing clinically well, mm-hmm. although I think the risk is low. But if I, as an individual patient, and I'm in remission on X drug, I don't want to be told I'm taking Y drug to save the system money. But so it's a complicated issue in North America. But the rest of the world, clearly, these drugs, when government-run healthcare systems, will save significant funds.
It's a no-brainer mm-hmm. in a one-payer
yeah.
system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for a patient to tell me that they've been approached and said that my copay is going to go down by 50 or 100 bucks if you switch. I haven't heard anything like that.
It's coming, though. It will happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. So a couple practical vignettes here. How do you evaluate for methotrexate intolerance? You have a drill of questions, or they just tell you, or how do you actually?
Yeah, I usually ask the questions. You know, kind of, are you having any nausea, GI upset, ulcers, hair loss? If I say that, they usually come back and tell me they have hair loss, even though if they don't, you know, that's like a big thing that they seem to be. And then obviously in my lab evaluation, you know, I'm going to look at their CBC count. But I just usually just go through the drill quickly, just mainly, mostly GI, I think, is the thing that upsets them the most. And then I would have to, you know, reduce the dose maybe in those scenarios.
What about the methotrexate blahs?
Oh, the fun, yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
There's no drill because the patients mm-hmm. make it clear to you, I don't want to mm-hmm. take this. Mm-hmm. I feel lousy for 24 to 48 hours after
yeah.
taking it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, they let us know now, you know. Mm-hmm. And the good news is now we have options. Mm-hmm. Previously we didn't, and we'd pat them on the back. And mm-hmm. as you said, Lynn, dextromethorphan or whatever we could come up with to reduce the headaches and so
right.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I mean, it certainly occurs in 20 to 30% of patients.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do my sermon prescribing methotrexate, I say, 7 to 8 out of 10 have no problem with this,
right.
but 2 to 3 are not going to be happy. So let's go through
right,
what it is.
Yeah, and go over, and that's why we start low and go
right.
slow. And
right.
Yeah.
So Stanley, there's a couple of patient algorithmic questions I think you can address. So if you have a patient who's on methotrexate and adalimumab, and the disease activity is very low or remission, what do you peel off?
Well, that's a tough one. I think that you need a small dose of methotrexate, which we did some studies on with infliximab in the past, and show that 7.5 milligrams of methotrexate, maybe even 5, was enough to reduce the risk of anti-drug antibodies. I think adalimumab and infliximab are different to horses, and I would probably just lower the dose of methotrexate to about 7.5 milligrams a day.
So tell us a little bit more about this immunogenicity
mm-hmm.
Thing. So which drugs do you worry about it with, and which drugs do you not worry about it with?
Well, generally the monoclonal antibodies are more of a risk, adalimumab and infliximab, and that's mm-hmm. been well shown throughout, and certainly our GI colleagues struggled with infliximab early on when they did not use concomitant methotrexate. It's interesting that other monoclonal antibodies like tocilizumab are very minimally immunogenic, mm-hmm. and I don't understand that. Abatacept is minimally immunogenic. Mm-hmm. Rituxan about 10%, but if we keep depleting B cells, you don't make antibodies, so mm-hmm. it's less of a problem long term. So it primarily boils down to adalimumab and infliximab,
mm-hmm.
And then the concomitant biosimilars will have the same issue. You know, we really don't know. We're so confused now with immunogenicity because, for example, with biosimilars, we're seeing anti-drug antibody rates of 50 to 70%.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're seeing neutralizing rates of, you know, antibodies of 20 to 30%,
mm-hmm.
and they have a modest impact on response. So we're just measuring a lot of things now. The assays are so sensitive, I'm not sure how we interpret them. But bottom line, be careful with infliximab and adalimumab.
But low dose methotrexate may be enough to
yes.
Protect against that.
Right.
I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
So you've gone through this the evolution of therapies, and we have all these choices. So today, if you have a patient who is failing methotrexate, where do you go to next?
Well, we don't have any data that shows in methotrexate incomplete responders, if you're continuing methotrexate, that any one therapy is better than the other. We have, you know, the Accelerate trial with, you know, certolizumab compared to adalimumab, it was no different. You know, we had abatacept compared to adalimumab, it was no different. So you can really pick what you're comfortable with. I think all of the biologics or targeted immune modulators are effective. I'm old school. I helped develop Intercept, so I usually go to a TNF inhibitor initially. The insurance company tells me which one I can use. Now, what is different, I think there's a growing wealth of data that shifting from one TNF failure just going to another TNF inhibitor probably is not the best thing to do. It works. But I think going to a different mechanism of action after a single TNF incomplete TNF inhibitor failure probably makes more sense based on various observational registries, poorly done clinical trials, and actually a couple reasonably done clinical trials demonstrating that when you have one TNF inhibitor failure, you go to a different MOA, you do better than going to a second TNF inhibitor if it's for lack of efficacy.
Is there any circumstance, and this is going back to guidelines, where a patient who's failing methotrexate, that you would stop methotrexate out of futility and go to a biologic monotherapy?
Well, I think I would do that in two situations. One, if the patient's having adverse events. And the second is they had zero response to methotrexate. Usually what you see, the real world experience, is they've had a partial response.
Right.
You know, they might have started with 10 swollen, 20 tender, and now they have 7 swollen and 14 tender. Mm-hmm. In those people, you're getting some benefit from the methotrexate, so you add to it. Now, if they go into deep remission, and it's not adalimumab or infliximab, I'm gonna try to withdraw the methotrexate mm-hmm. long term.
So Eileen, when you're talking to a patient about, so they're failing methotrexate and now they have this biologic choice and you're giving them your initial kind of drill on safety, what do you generally tell them?
Well, I talk about the infection risk and I talk about how, you know, if it's going to be a sub-Q injection, most likely the injection site reaction is going to be the most common, you know, side effect. But because it suppresses the immune system, if they're going to have any fever, they're going to have to go on antibiotics. This is a medication they're going to have to hold. They're going to have to avoid live vaccines. So, you know, I go through that whole regimen with them and let them know they need to reach out to me if that were to happen. If they're going to go in for surgery, that's another reason to hold the medication. And then I'll go over the cancer risk, the lymphoma risk, which is very small, less than 1%, and just having the disease itself increases your risk. So I reassure them, I try to reassure them about that. And then, of course, the skin cancer risk. And then that's pretty much what I review with them. And I just explain that, you know, what they see on TV and, you know, what we see in our practices and for the amount of years I've been in it, you know, they should feel overall reassured as long as they're coming in.
Yeah, TV is an issue in this country. United States and New Zealand are the only ones that have this.
Really?
I'm not a big fan of branded direct-to-consumer. So what about, Stanley, what do you think that the impact of the oral option is? You know, is that the first thing that you throw out to people, that you have an option of, you know, the dosing route, or
you have to have that discussion with the patient that we do have, you know, and so what you're balancing is, what we had been balancing was 20 years of experience with Etanercept and adalimumab. So we know that over 5 million people have received each one of those. Mm-hmm. And we know that up until about a year ago, I think 100,000 people had received tofacitinib. Mm-hmm. So now the use of tofacitinib, I think, is rapidly accelerating because patients and physicians, it takes a while for physician extenders to become more comfortable mm-hmm. with a new mechanism of action. So I think we're all becoming more comfortable with that, and it has to be one of the treatment options. And then you have to fight the fight with the pre-authorization. Mm-hmm. Tofacitinib is not always first tier, and if it is a first tier, then you can certainly try it mm-hmm. on a particular patient. And in the beginning, when the tofacitinib was available, I think I was more reluctant in patients with comorbidities because mm-hmm. I knew so much more about etanercept and adalimumab and right. so forth. But I think that a lot of that has fallen by the wayside.
Right, it was just comfort over time.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Here's a patient question, and I know it's just a patient question, but in general, I think this deserves a good answer here.
Have we given any bad answers yet?
No.
After the broadcast.
So this individual is on hydroxychloroquine, been taking it for 12 years, has flare-ups 2 to 3 times a month, has been afraid of biologics, has a rheumatoid factor of 1,000, with normal acute phase reactants in general. What do you think of that therapy at this point in time?
Something stronger.
Need something stronger.
For sure.
They need a reassessment, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. And then, you know, we don't minimize the safety issues of any of these drugs, but remember that, you know, having uncontrolled disease is a safety issue at risk as well. And the inflammation is not only in your joints, but it's in your arteries and throughout your body. And you know, we don't undersell safety, but by and large, when used properly, these drugs are both efficacious and well tolerated.
Well, what we do in our day-to-day clinic is we all day long, it's a benefit-risk analysis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's what you need to have that discussion. There are no therapies without side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, if you have one, you're not going to be happy. But the benefits of these therapies way outweigh the risk.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a hard concept for a number of patients to understand.
All right, here's a question asking for a brief response. Where can nurses learn to perform a joint exam?
Well, I have in the toolkit, there was a video.
Where can that be accessed?
I can get it for them. I just don't recall
and I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
so for clinical trials,
mm-hmm,
there are tutorials,
mm-hmm,
about the proper joint exam, and I can't imagine they're not on the web.
Right.
Well, I actually watched Larry Moreland teach joint exam on YouTube. It's probably still up there. So
that's where I got this.
And
mm-hmm.
Do RNS mm-hmm. have teaching tools for this?
They do, yeah.
I would check the Rheumatology mm-hmm. Nursing Society do a shout out on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
What about smoking in these diseases? Besides it being bad, does it affect the therapies as well as what are the ramifications of smoking rheumatoid?
Well, I mean, there's some data that smoking increases the risk of RA in ACPA positive patients.
Mm-hmm.
RA patients have a higher risk of lung cancer to begin with, so smoking it should be prohibited. And then there's modest data, not very strong data, that smoking may impact response
mm-hmm.
to treatment. But
mm-hmm.
certainly, as far as the trigger of the disease and the risk of lung cancer, mm-hmm. and also the increased cardiovascular risk that RA patients have, smoking is a real problem.
Right.
I'm getting a shout out here from somebody in West Virginia, so almost heaven. I see a lot of patients with RA and have to weed through the mess of immunizations. What recommendations on vaccination can you give, and if patients on biologics? This is a complicated topic, and actually on my Cleveland Clinic website, we have a couple formal presentations on this, and if you just Google me and send me a note at the clinic, I'll steer you to this. It's an important issue. Infections are by and large preventable. Obviously, patients on biologics, live vaccines are problematic. The only live vaccine that we've worried about by and large in adults that aren't international traveling has been Zostavax, and now the recommended vaccine shingles is now Shingrix. That's ACIP recommendation. Just a couple words about this vaccine. It's two vaccines administered a few months apart. It is not live, but it is adjuvanted and has a potent adjuvant. And there are palpable adverse events that are transient relatively benign, of injection site reactions, sometimes some myalgia, fever that last a day or two. There's some ongoing discussion in rheumatology circles because this has not been tested robustly in patients with active rheumatic diseases. And you know, what you don't know, you don't know. We are using Shingrix and we're recommending it, but there. The company, GSK, is forthrightly moving forward to try to sort this data out and to produce the type of data that will reassure us. The rest of it is good vaccine management. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you mm-hmm. how important advanced practitioners are in this. Doctors, mm-hmm. we're the last ones to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. I depend upon Betsy, who's so much more expert in scheduling mm-hmm. these things than mm-hmm. I am at the present time. Mm-hmm. And that's been shown that you got to change the system in your office, mm-hmm. Whether it's handing a patient a reminder, say to remind the doctor, or do something that makes it routine.
Yeah.
And what do you guys do?
Usually in my note, I have like an infection area, and I just make sure that every year, you know, I update it. I always look at it. And
flu vaccines are fine. All rheumatoid mm-hmm. should have Prime Boost, Prevnar, Pneumovax, and then be up to date on your DPT and then DT reimmunization. So there's a lot of great resources out there right now. We didn't talk at all about triple therapy. Is that something you believe or you not believe, or what is it?
You can't not believe it. I mean, there's enough data that the triple mm-hmm. therapy, which is hydroxychloroquine, sulfasalazine, and methotrexate, mm-hmm. is effective.
Why don't we talk about it more?
Well, I think that I'm not convinced about the long-term retention of triple therapy. I think short-term, a head-to-head trial, 6 to 12 months, 24 months, you can see similar benefit. But I think long-term, most patients don't adhere to the medications.
Right.
And I'm also concerned it's maybe not quite as effective as far as preventing radiographic progression. But a very, very reasonable therapy mm-hmm. if you have a patient, you're concerned about a malignancy issue and they're mm-hmm. concerned about biologics
right.
or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
We need more dietitians that work with rheumatologists, in my opinion. Any thoughts about this? I have a lot of thoughts about this, actually, and I agree 100%. Organizations like Creaky Joints are doing a lot for putting out very good information on healthy diets. There are a lot of information on the role of diets in arthritis, and I don't want to make this sound like I'm saying that diets are remittive, but an anti-inflammatory diet has been shown to do two things. Number one, in population studies, it forestalls the onset of rheumatoid arthritis on a population base. So if you're on a prudent diet versus a standard American diet, the SAD diet, you are offered some protection. Secondly, looking at the content of your diet by merely adding fish, in particular cold water fish, cross-sectional data suggests that reproducibly, you find that patients with that type of diet have significantly lower disease activity measures. So it's a no-brainer. It's good for your health all around. It can help and contribute to some aspects of your disease. There's a lot of good resources on the web. I think that e-coaching is a great way to go.
Right.
Well, you didn't mention weight reduction, because our drugs don't work as well in the obese.
Mm-hmm.
And
very
that's been
point.
Well shown.
Mm-hmm.
And even studies have suggested bariatric surgery.
Right.
Patients have better outcomes after bariatric surgeries, which probably enhances ability for our
right.
drugs to be effective.
Right. And it's not enough just to ask our patients to lose weight. We have to give them some tools
right.
and some tips.
Boy, these are getting more complicated, not less complicated. Stanley, I'm a patient, and I watched a TV commercial about this medicine you want to give me, and it says I'm going to get cancer from it. What do you say?
Well, I think we have plenty of data over the last 20 years that the biologics do not increase the risk of solid cell cancer, whether it be lung cancer, renal cancer, ovarian cancer. That's clear. The lymphoma, we feel comfortable. The risk, I think, is not increased by the medications, as you, Eileen,
mm-hmm.
mentioned. It's probably related to disease activity and the underlying disease itself, which is an upregulation of the immune system. We don't have the best data yet in patients who've already had cancer. The data that we have seems to be gratifying that we don't increase the risk with continuing biologic therapy, but we don't have a robust population set. But so, you know, that I think that everything is a benefit risk, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
RA, if left untreated, lowers your lifespan. You usually die a decade earlier, you're debilitated, your quality of life is poor, so you have to have that discussion.
says in these labels that we need to check lipids with some of these drugs. Is that rheumatologists, are we doing cardiovascular risk reduction now? What's our role here?
Well, the lipid issue, I mean, that we should be, yes, because our patients have a higher risk, and we need to work closely with our PCPs mm-hmm. to do that. We're not adept in doing that. But certainly any of the therapies that inhibit IL-6, which, you know, the tocilizumab and sarilumab, as well as the JAK inhibitors, which block IL-6, there is about a 10 to 15% increase in HDL and LDL, and we need to monitor that. And those small percentage of patients, we can treat them if necessary. We don't do enough managing comorbidities, and we need to work closer with primary care to do mm-hmm. that.
And we need to actively engage in smoking cessation. We need good referral
yeah.
patterns and mm-hmm. tools for this. This is not something that's mm-hmm. just enough to identify. We
right.
actually have to intervene. So mm-hmm. anyway, it's gone by like a blink of an eye
yes,
here.
Yes.
A fabulous job for both of you. I really want to thank you for throwing in. I also want to thank the patients who were interviewed and provide us with all this feedback that helped shape the program today and sure, to ensure that we included the key issues that were important to them. Thanks to CME Outfitters for your incredible assistance in developing this educational activity. And finally, thank you for those of you that took the time to sit with us. We know you're so busy. This is pulling you away from patient care, but we hope it was worthwhile. So I'm Dr. Len Calabrese. I'd love for you to follow me on Twitter. I promise that send you some good stuff and keep you entertained at the same time. I hope you can incorporate many of these recommendations into your optimal care paths. So thanks again.